Good morning. I hope everyone has paper. There's more of it by the hot water. I'll ask, as usual, for people to please put their phones on vibrate, silent, whatever works. Thank you very much for coming to week six. I always get worried when you have a mini-series that runs more than 3 or 4 weeks. You know, at the end, you can peter out, so I'm glad to have company. I also have finally produced the flyer for the next series. I hope to send it out by email later today. The series is January 10th to 31st, 4 weeks. It's a blend of Jewish history and Tanakh. The title is Game of Thrones, the Persia edition. So we'll be talking about various Persian kings and the intrigues of their courts. One obviously is going to have to be Ahasuerus, because you can't do that in January, especially without discussing the Purim story. So that will be one of them, but we're also going to be talking about Cyrus. We'll be talking about a king named Darius, another king named Artaxasta, which is quite the name, Artaxasta. It took me a long time to learn to say it, so I'm going to say it as many times as I can at this point. But that's going to be, God willing, 4 weeks in January. Same setup as we did for this series. It'll be $40 for the series. If people want to pay $10 per week, that's fine as well. I'm looking forward to that. Okay. Logotherapy is our topic for today. How many people have heard of logotherapy? Only for me. Okay, you know, several people have heard of it. My son keeps on looking at it and thinking it's Lego therapy. Lego therapy may be more effective. I don't know. Logo therapy, the art of learning to read advertisements without cringing. Logo therapy. Okay, sorry. They can't all be winners. So logotherapy is a method of therapy, of treatment, developed by Dr. Viktor Frankl, who I hope you've heard of. We'll be talking a lot about him. And I think it has a lot to say in relation to the conditions we've been talking about, the various mental health issues we've been dealing with. I want to acknowledge at the outset that Rabbi Reuven Bolka from Ottawa has done tremendous work in this field and wrote many papers on the topic. His work has taught me a great deal about it. And he's also been available by email, and I've consulted him on a couple of points. So that's been very, very useful. As always, I am certainly not a therapist. I am not recommending anything particular for anyone's particular situation. But I do want to discuss this because I think there's a lot we can learn from the concept of logotherapy. I brought you the first few sources on the sheet to show you something remarkable. The range of applications for this method of therapy is very broad. The core concept of logotherapy, which we're going to have to obviously unpack and explore, is the idea that human beings need meaning, or more correctly, need to be searching for meaning in their lives. And we're going to have to define what meaning is. But right now, I'm just going to call it a sense of purpose. That's not a full definition, but it'll work for what we're going to talk about just in the next couple of sources here, sources 1 and 2. Because these are about applications of logotherapy, the first case for dealing with adolescent depression, and the second one, internet addiction. This is from a paper, Helping Older Adolescents. It's a longer title than that, but it'll do. On a weekly basis, over a 3-week period, he's talking about a particular case, this adolescent scored an average of 40 on the BDI, the Beck Depression Inventory, indicating severe depression. Reviewing his scores on the BDI and verbalizing his various problems, he further recognized the enormous weight of his depression. Following this 3-week period, after we had developed rapport, I assisted him in reframing the meaning of his depression by asking him to think about its possible meaning, and then asking, let's assume that your depression is purposeful, that it's trying to convey a message to you, telling you that some change needs to be made in your life. Your job is to figure out what that change is, and then to make it. And here I'm going to pause and note what we said when we talked about depression, which is therapy is not going to work on depression that is biochemical in nature unless you're also taking care of the biochemistry. So the medicinal part can't be ignored in favor of this. You can't speak to somebody this way if they're dealing with a biochemical imbalance first. Okay. Yeah.
Could you just tell us, what is this person Blair's expertise? What is his...
So he is a psychologist. Yeah, he is psychologist. I don't believe psychiatrist, I believe psychologist, but I'm not 100% sure of that. So he tells the teen, right, assume that there's some kind of message you're supposed to be getting here, that this is, that the depression is not simply a state of being, but that it's actually, it's a message, there's something wrong, something that needs to be done differently. After taking sufficient time to think, he responded that he had always wanted to read philosophy, but had never taken the time to do so. We discussed some of the titles he wanted to read. And when the book Atlas Shrugged was mentioned, he became excited and decided that was the book he would read. He purchased and read the book. Within a 2-week period and with no additional interventions, his score on the BDI dropped to 10, indicating a normal mood range. Who would have thought Atlas Shrugged? Question. First time in the history, that's for sure. The concept that Blair is trying to bring across here is the idea that sometimes the person's depression, in this particular case, is not only about depression, but sometimes the mental health issue is a sense that the person has that they're adrift, that they're not pursuing the goals that the pursuit of which would bring them fulfillment, and what they need to do is to find what that pursuit is for them and to engage in it. That's the goal that he identifies for this teen and says this method works very well for adolescent depression. There's another study, and I have studies and studies and studies, we could have had the entire source sheet be filled with it, but another one regarding geriatric depression. There was a professor who was retired, didn't have family around, and was just wasting away. The depression was keeping him indoors, isolated, and so on. And the therapist talks to this retired professor about his life, his career, and so on. And he notices that the professor brightens up when talking about his colleagues, the people he had worked with, discussed, and debated, and so on. And eventually starts to get him in touch with those colleagues, and they meet one day for lunch, and they come over, and that's what brings him out of the depression, is the engagement with the colleagues he had known. I brought you another example of it, something quite different, not depression, but internet addiction. You can tell that this is 2012 and written by somebody who may be a little older, because he's going to mention MySpace. But the internet addiction, particularly when it is related to social networking programs such as Facebook, MySpace, or Second Life, is indicative of the existential concept of escaping from the self rather than reliance on self. When someone has, he says, an internet addiction, it may have nothing to do with the internet. The internet is simply the escape route. But the more relevant point, what's underlying it, is the desire not to deal with one's self. Individuals feel the need to escape the self for different reasons. It, the self, may have become burdensome, empty, a source of embarrassment, or repulsive. Addictive behaviors are the pathological result of this dissatisfaction with or rejection of the self. And that goes back to what we talked about when we dealt with addiction as a topic. But it's the search for an escape. And again, he talks about helping the person to find meaningful activity that will help them out of this state. And then, source number 3, someone sent me this the end of the summer, that appeared only in August 2017, in JAMA Psychiatry. Studies that were done on measuring physical function in older adults who found that they had some kind of purpose, that they were in fact doing something that brought them a sense of meaning. Purpose in life was prospectively associated with a decreased risk of developing weak grip strength and slow walking speed, although the findings were more robust for walking speed than for grip strength. These findings suggest that a sense of purpose in life, which is a modifiable factor, may play an important role in maintaining physical function among older adults. Physiological application of what is fundamentally a psychological, emotional state. But it can have applications for one's physical health. So what I want to do over the course of our time this morning is talk about what this is, this logotherapy approach. You know, where does it come from? What is it? Does it have parallels within Judaism? That's basically where I want to go with it. Okay. So far, so good?
Yeah.
Yes?
Quick question. In the Torah or the Talmud anywhere, is there any mention of coaching, counseling, therapy? You know, we often think of Freud, and of course, there's always some sense that Freud just borrowed it from.
Yes.
Right. So where is the concept of seeking out the advice or the counsel of someone with a certain amount of wisdom come from?
So it's a good question. It's a little broader than where I'm going to be going this morning, but I'll give you, the source. The first source that jumps to mind is a source that I think we discussed a little bit last week, actually, is when Joseph is in jail. Right? Joseph is in jail in Egypt, along with the king's butler and the king's baker, and they have their frightening dreams the night before that they don't know what to make of. And Joseph wakes up in the morning, and it's the text says, "Vayaro tambihi nam zoafim." He sees that they are upset. Something has made them agitated, and he asks them, "What's going on?" And they relate the dream to him, and then he proceeds to try to give them an interpretation, which calms them, although one of them ends up dead. But, you know, therapy's like that. The idea of somebody speaking to somebody else and asking them to relate to their problem and what is agitating them, would be one. To put it more abstractly, though, I would go with Mishlei, with Proverbs, where it says, Daga belev ish, if worry is in the heart of a person, if someone is anxious, the text says, Yishchena. Or Yischana, there are two different ways to read the line. The Talmud notes both ways. In one version of the text, it's saying if worry is in somebody's heart, he should simply forget about it, remove it. The other way to read it, though, which the Talmud mentions, is he should speak to somebody else about it, and the act of speech is itself therapeutic. So that would be another example you could offer. There's probably a lot more, but I'm gonna go back towards the logotherapy specifically. So logos, it means what? Sorry? So yeah, it's used as word from the way that the Christians actually use it. But the core concept of logos is meaning or purpose. That's actually as I understand it anyway. The core meaning of the term. Viktor Frankl, Dr. Viktor Frankl, I shouldn't take away his title, believed in the idea that human beings each have a unique nature and purpose. Purpose not in the sense of, he's not talking about divine purpose, you were designed to do a particular job, but in the sense that there is a mission or set of missions which will resonate with a person and give them a sense of meaning as they pursue them. And let's start with his basic point about the nature of human beings. He said each person is unique. If you take a look at source number 5 on your sheet, source number 4 is an archived lecture that I gave to doctors on logotherapy. It's more extensive in certain directions than what we're going to discuss today. But take a look at number 5. Tasks form man's destiny, which is different and unique for each individual. No man and no destiny can be compared with any other man or any other destiny. No situation repeats itself, and each situation calls for a different response. Each situation is different, each person is different. Now, you may be familiar with the book that this is coming from, Man's Search for Meaning, right? Hopefully people are. Man's Search for Meaning is Dr. Frankl's memoir. Half of it describes his experiences in the Holocaust, because he was indeed a survivor, something we're going to come back to. And then half of it describes the basic ideas of logotherapy. He links the two because observations he made during and after the war very much figure into his concept of logotherapy, even though the idea itself was pre-war. So he says, each person is unique and each situation is unique. And he argues that each of us is influenced by instinct. Each of us is influenced by whatever we inherit in our genes. Each of us is influenced by our environment, the way we are raised, the friends we keep, the people we meet at work, the world in which we live. They're all influences, but we fundamentally have free will, and we use it to respond to all of those influences as we search for meaning. And take a look at source number 6. He says, this is from The Doctor and the Soul, you can see the heading. Most of the papers that I'm going to quote are available online. If anyone wants a particular paper and needs a link for it, I'll be glad to send you. Certainly man is free, he says, but he is not floating freely in airless space. He is always surrounded by a host of restrictions. Right? There are all sorts of things that guide, influence, shape our activities. For anyone coming in now, there are still sheets by the hot water, I think. These restrictions, however, are the jumping off points for his freedom. Freedom presupposes restrictions, is contingent upon restrictions. He says, all the different factors that make up our lives should not be viewed as fighting with our freedom. The point of our freedom is the ability to choose how we will respond to these different factors. If we wanted to define man, he says, we would have to call him that entity which has freed itself from whatever has determined it. Meaning, determined it as biological, psychological, sociological type. That entity, in other words, that transcends all these determinants, either by conquering them and shaping them, or by deliberately submitting to them. And that's an important point, that word that he used towards the end. He says, man is defined as the creature that transcends those factors that influence their lives, or submits to them. But he notes that that submission is deliberate. Meaning, a person should not say, in his view of how the human psyche works, a person should not say, I'm just who I am because of the way that I was raised, whatever, you know, the world in which I live, and it just happened, because that's a choice as well. That's a decision that we make as well. If we submit to those things, it's deliberate. That's the way he looks at it. And this is not This is not something that he feels a need to argue. He doesn't provide philosophical arguments to demonstrate that there is such a thing as free will. As far as he is concerned, it's observable just by seeing the way that different people will respond to a particular stimulus. And he gives you an extreme case. And the extreme case is starvation in the concentration camps. He says, take a look at source number 7 here. From a paper, an analysis of the viability of Frankl's logotherapeutic system as a secular theory by Rabbi Bolka, who needs shorter titles. In the paper, he quotes Frankl on this issue of free will. He says, freedom, to Frankl, demands no special proof. It belongs, quote, to the immediate data of his experience. Freud once said the following, try and subject a number of very strongly differentiated human beings to the same amount of starvation. With the increase of the imperative need for food, all individual differences will be blotted out, and in their place we shall see the uniform expression of the one unsatisfied instinct. Freud's argument is, your instincts are who you are, and if the instinct becomes strong enough, then all of your different human traits and all the different ways in which you identify yourself, the things you think about your personality, disappear in the face of that instinct. And Frankl says, I'm sorry, but I've lived it, and it's not true. He says, the concentration camps here, the top of the next slide, in Frankl's view, proved Freud wrong. The camps proved that man cannot be reduced to a function of heredity and environment, for at the same time that some inmates degenerated into the innate camp bestiality, others exhibited the virtues of saintliness. A third variable found only in the spiritual animal, man. He is not using spiritual as the same thing as religious. We're going to come back to that. But he says, the spiritual animal, man, is the decisive factor in human behavior, choice or decision. Quote, man ultimately decides for himself. The fact that in the camps, people are put in the position of just the basic instinct of survival, the need to get food, and yet different people responded differently, is not attributable, he says, to their genetics, is not attributable to their upbringing, is attributable rather to a decision that they made. That's the argument that Frankl gives. Frankly, I think you could very well take a different approach to the evidence that he's bringing and say, well, it was from their background and so on, but he's the one who was there and I was not. And his argument is, it didn't break down that way. It wasn't that people who came from selfless homes therefore gave their bread to other people, and people who came from more selfish backgrounds, sought to feed themselves. It didn't work that way. And that's, he says, is the strongest evidence he's going to give you for the existence of free will, but he believes this to be basic to the nature of the human being. Along with this idea that we have free will, I'm not even talking about Jewish concepts right now, we're just dealing with it from the logotherapy perspective, then we're going to come back to the relationship of this to Judaism. So he says, in addition to this idea of free will, is the idea that we need to pursue meaning. So what is meaning? How would you define meaning? Purpose? Purpose? Could be?
That which satiates.
In other words, you know it when you feel it. Right? Meaning is that which gives a person a sense of satisfaction. Could be, Elaine?
And then challenge achieved.
A challenge? Okay. Shauna?
I think it's taking something, let's say, for example, like getting cancer. Today's 11 years of my getting cancer, and I'm okay. So taking that to be meaningful experience for me is like helping other people who were sick, or seeing it as a bigger picture outside of
my outside of yourself. Experience. So projecting outside of yourself.
Yeah.
First of all, mazel tov.
But, okay,
so that would be so taking it beyond.
Yeah.
Okay.
Taking it beyond, yeah.
Good. Judith.
Making a meaningful difference.
Making a meaningful difference. What does that mean? Give me more to work with.
What you engage in has an impact on people around you, community, translating into meaningful difference in the life.
So also going beyond yourself then. Okay, Rita.
It could also mean for oneself. It could then to insight into oneself in terms of maybe in terms of personal or spiritual
right.
growth and change them.
Finding something within oneself. Okay, Stephen, and then I'm going to go a little further with this.
The road to feeling closer to God.
The road to feeling closer to God. Oh boy. So what we've done here, if you've noticed, is that to some extent we've talked about the definition of meaning. So to say a characteristic of meaning is that it will bring me a sense of satisfaction, let's say. But then we've also gotten into examples of meaning and talked about, not examples of meaning even, but examples of activities that bring meaning. And some have talked about things that were personal, some have talked about things that were external to themselves, and some have gone the religious route. Yeah.
Hearing you summarize that, I think we missed one of the main words about meaning in life. It's like fulfillment. The word fulfillment is one we probably use more often in our life. When we
yes.
feel that our days are fulfilling, or our profession, or whatever it is you're doing
right.
has fulfillment.
Right.
For you.
Right. So here we get into a very interesting problem, and it really applies also to the satisfaction idea. Is meaning the same thing as fulfillment and satisfaction, or is meaning that which brings about fulfillment and satisfaction? So let's see what Frankl does with this. These are all important points. Take a look, please, at source number 8. He says, and this is Rybulka commenting on Frankl's idea. He says, the human model, the perfectly functioning man, is, and again, man here is generic, please don't be insulted, it's man, woman, fine. The human model, the properly functioning man, is directed towards meaning. If meaning were subjective, the dynamics of transcendence would be destroyed and existence would falter. Therefore, meaning must be objective. Let me unpack that and explain what he means by objective versus subjective. What he's suggesting is, meaning is my reaction to participating in something which is objectively valuable, objectively valuable means that it benefits something besides me. It isn't about feeding myself. There is something bigger, which may include me, but there's something that transcends, and that's a big word for Frankl, is transcendent. Something that transcends being just about me. He then goes on to say, the second paragraph here, number 8, Frankl does categorize 3 species of values contained in life. They are creative values, or what man gives to life. Experiential values, or what man takes from the world in terms of his experience. And attitudinal values, or the stand man takes toward an unchangeable aspect of his existence. In other words, finding meaning does not have to be about engaging in a particular activity. That's usually what we think of, right? When someone says, come up with a list of meaningful things, so your reaction, depending on your bent, may be learning something, may be going to a soup kitchen and feeding people in need, may be prayer. You think of what I do, in terms of pursuit of meaning. But from Frankl's perspective, that isn't necessarily what's involved. Experiencing something can be meaningful. Experiencing, not an act of doing, but simply experiencing. You sit on your porch and the world happens to you, so to speak. That is also a way to find meaning, or even just the attitude that one takes to an experience, sometimes, as he writes here, to something that you can't change anyway. The way in which one looks at one's life itself can be meaningful. And it can be in any field. It could be in one's career. It could be in one's leisure. It could be in any aspect of one's life. But here's a key thing. It's not about becoming better. It's not about making myself a better person. It's not about becoming more self-aware or actualizing my potential. Those things may happen along the way, but they're not the point.
It's more distinctive.
To a certain extent, yeah. But it's about finding value and purpose that isn't about me. It's not about what I'm going to get out of it. It's not about how I'm going to grow through it. The activity has some kind of meaning, and there's that word, that you're not supposed to use the word to define itself, but the activity has some kind of value outside of the way it transforms me, what it does for me, and so on. It's not mine. However, and this is where objective and subjective get tricky, it's defined by me. I am the one who has to find it as meaningful. No one else can give me an activity to perform and say, that's a meaningful activity. You have a young mother who's taking care of children, and she makes dinner for them, right, night after night. And she says, you know what, I don't have any meaning. I don't have any sense that what I'm doing is meaningful. And someone says to her, but you're keeping your children alive and nourished, and isn't that a wonderful thing to be doing? You can't say that. You can't say that to her. She doesn't find meaning in it. You can't tell somebody this is meaningful. And in that sense, it is subjective. Take a look at source number 9, please. Yeah?
But you can tell somebody and then they see, yeah, you're right. It is meaningful what I'm doing.
Right, so the question is, and this is a fascinating question within logotherapy, as he points out, can you lead people to find meaning in what they're doing? Can it be that someone engages in activity and doesn't realize what it's doing, and maybe then they will find it to be meaningful? It's an interesting question. I think there's a logic to it. But take a look at number 9. Go ahead.
I have trouble with the word objective.
Yeah.
Because I may find something meaningful and gives me purpose, and
Right. And I think that's exactly the point. I think it's exactly the point. Meaning, it is objective It is objective in the sense that it helps someone, or even help is the wrong word, in the sense that it's associated with something outside of myself. That's how it's objective. But it is subjective in the sense that only I can in the end determine whether the pursuit of this is meaningful for me. The objective piece of it is in terms of the activity itself not being about me. If I live my entire life trying to feed myself, according to Frankl, I will not find meaning that way. If I live my entire life trying to feed someone else, I might find it meaningful, I might not. It fits the criteria of being transcendent, of being outside of me, but I may not find that a meaningful activity. It could be that does nothing for me. Take a look at source number 9, please. I want to move towards this. The job at which one works, he says, is not what counts, but rather the manner in which one does the work. It does not lie with the occupation, but always with us. Whether those elements of the personal and the specific, which constitute the uniqueness of our existence, are expressed in the work and thus make life meaningful. It's going to matter. It's my relationship with it that fundamentally is going to matter. That's the way that he looks at it. And what we need is to be engaged in that search. That's Frankl's proposition. He has defined human beings as beings with free will and beings who have a need to pursue that which will provide meaning for them, which he argues comes from engagement with something, with an activity, with an experience, whatever it is, that isn't just about me. That's outside of myself. And there's a need, he says, to be engaged in that search. Take a look at number 10, please. Going back to Iboka's paper. Man, like the decrepit ark, needs a pulling tension, right? Meaning, if you have something that's in orbit, right? If it's in orbit, eventually gravity is going to pull it downward towards the middle. What keeps it going? What is it that keeps it in orbit? Well, the inertia of whatever put it in orbit in the first place. But what it really needs in order to remain in orbit is something external that's exerting a pull that balances the Earth, if it's in orbit around the Earth. You need something else. This pulling tension is what he's describing here. You need that. Man oscillates between the subjective I am and the objective I ought. And insofar as he strives for the ought, he transcends his self and actualizes his responsibleness. In other words, what he's trying to say, I think, is there's the subjective I need to feed myself. There's the objective move towards transcendence, towards something that is not me. And it isn't about me getting to that point. It's not about me arriving at a state in which what I am doing is meaningful. It's about me trying to get there in the first place. That's the pulling tension. What we need is the search, to be looking for that, so that even if you reach that end, right, and you've gotten to your goal of doing something that is meaningful, in order to stay healthy, you need to start looking for something else. That's the way it works. We talked about relaxation last week. Relaxation is so last week. That was November. If you take a look at source number 12, sorry, number 12, number 11, in The Doctor and the Soul, he says, "We must never be content with what has already been achieved. Life never ceases to put new questions to us, never permits us to come to rest." And in the event that we can't search, or in the event that the search becomes frustrating, that we're not finding what we're looking for, that, he argues, leads to neurosis. A state in which one is not healthy mentally and emotionally, that can lead to depression, it reduces the will to act, so that he talks about the Sunday neurosis. I think I gave this quote in a previous session as well, in source number 12. From Psychotherapy and Existentialism. "The spiritual crisis of retirement constitutes, so to speak, a permanent unemployment neurosis. But there's also a temporary, periodical one, the Sunday neurosis, a depression which afflicts people who become conscious of the lack of content in their lives, the existential vacuum, when the rush of the busy week stops on Sunday and the void within them suddenly becomes manifest. It doesn't mean they're not doing things. It doesn't mean that they don't have a full schedule of things to do, but that those activities don't involve the search for meaning is what frustrates and what makes it difficult. You know people, you may find them in the mirror, who have problems going on vacation. Right? They can't do it. And in fact, if you find them on a beach somewhere, in a chair, just sitting there, and they don't have a phone, and they don't have a book that they really want to read, or whatever it is, they can't cope. They aren't able to cope with it, and they may go looking for something that will get them to stop feeling bad about their current state. Marilyn says they may start drinking. Right? That's not a joke. That's not a joke. It's very serious. Yeah?
Wouldn't they have to be predisposed to learning as part of their nature and nurture? All these things that you've said, wouldn't they have to be predisposed their nature to learning something?
So, Frankl believes we are. He says that's basic to our identity as human beings. Marilyn asks, does this mean that don't they have to be predisposed to learning? I mean, learning in the broad sense of the word.
Yes.
But gaining something from your experiences. Yes, Nanette. So you're saying that the individual is listening to something from within or from without? Interesting. Right. He is suggesting, as Nanette points out, that there is an inner voice, an inner drive would be the way that I would frame it. But yes, that is looking and that can be distracted from it, and that when we're distracted from it, then we stop looking or we get diverted. Right. I think it's a fair statement. I saw a couple of hands. Yeah.
Well, I'm a bit confused, but are we going to get back to depression, which is our starting point?
So the
application.
So that's one of the applications, right? We talked about the adolescent and the geriatric in the beginning,
right.
But it's not the only application. But I think that the application to depression at this point is, you know, fits in with the stories we just read, right? About the Sunday neurosis or about retirement and so on. Yeah. I think it's true. I think that the depression is associated with, and again, I distinguish between the biochemical and the psychological. But from the psychological aspect of it, he absolutely believes that a person with depression is essentially receiving a message, call it the internal voice if you like, but is receiving a message that they're not engaged in this search for meaning. They haven't found a meaningful activity to pursue, and they don't feel like they are progressing towards such a thing through a search. And that's where they're stuck.
I think it ties in with what you're saying, because it's the you're not hearing it. It's there, but you're not coming out for you because of your depression or whatever it is you're suffering from.
Or you're not answering it. You're not.
Right. Right. I'm going to go a little further. I saw more hands, but I just looked at the clock. So I'm going to go a little bit further here. How does somebody identify that which is meaningful to them? How do you get to that point where you know, okay, so here is where I can find meaning? So each situation is different. Frankl, as quoted by Bolke in source number 13, says, you can't just say, well, what's a meaningful activity? Let me get a book off the shelf, and the book will list meaningful activities, and I'll just flip through them. That doesn't work, because it's about your situation. It's about who you are. It has to be something that resonates with you. So that Frankl says, it's like in number 13, he says, it will be like asking a chess player, what's the best move in chess? Right? There is no such thing. It doesn't make any sense. It depends what's on the board. Further, he says, and this goes back to a point I had mentioned before, he says it in number 14, it goes without saying that meaning and purpose in life are no matter of prescription. It is not the job of a doctor to give meaning to the patient's life. But it may well be his task, through an existential analysis, to enable the patient to find meaning in life. And in my opinion, meaning is something to be found rather than to be given. You can't say to somebody, this is meaningful, it doesn't work. They have to be the one to find it. You can help them look, and whether that's, as Etty said, by showing them different facets of what they are doing, or whether it's by introducing them to new lines of thinking that may help them along the way, that's the role of the counselor in this. Now, that inevitably leads to one key question, which, this is now the third time I've spoken on logotherapy, and each time I get a better, more clear understanding of what's going on, but I keep coming back to the same question that someone put to me the first time I spoke about this, which is, so could somebody find meaning in criminal activity? In criminal activity, right? I find meaning in theft. You know? Or could somebody find meaning? What if you have somebody whose religion teaches them that you will find fulfillment and that it's righteous to take a rifle and go shoot people who don't agree with you? Will that person find meaning in that kind of activity? It's a frightening question, but I think it's one you have to ask. And I think, to my mind, while I think that Frankl would be uncomfortable with this conclusion, the answer may be yes. Meaning is not inherently healthy in terms of society. If you take a look on your sheet at source number 15, I asked Ray Bulka this question, and he referred me to Frankl's Man's Search for Ultimate Meaning. Right? As opposed to Man's Search for Meaning, this is the one with 50% more. And in this book, Frankl talks about an unconscious religiosity that people have. Not religiosity in terms of a particular religion, but a sense of a spiritual and a sense of something that is, to go beyond spiritual, there is something outside themselves that defines what is meaningful and what is not. Take a look at what he says in 15. This may help more than any description I can give. The starting point in the thinking that he's describing in this chapter, the starting point was the basic phenomenological fact that being human is being conscious and being responsible. The second stage of development was reached when experiential analysis ventured into unconscious spirituality. Meaning, the unconscious logos was disclosed with the discovery of a spiritual unconscious in addition to the instinctual unconscious. Meaning, that a human being, in addition to all of their instincts that operate without them even thinking about it, a human being has a spirit that is looking for meaning, even if we don't think about it consciously. That's where he is at this stage. And then he says, now in its third stage of development, existential analysis has uncovered within the spiritual unconscious religiousness, a latent relation to transcendence inherent in man. If one prefers, one might conceive of this relation in terms of a relationship between the immanent self and a transcendent thou, meaning God of some kind. But the point that Frankl is making here is that maybe, just like we've already said, that within the human being there's a drive for meaning in working on something that is working towards something that is outside of oneself, so there is also a set of criteria for meaning outside of oneself, not a product of what we personally believe and like. And you could use those criteria to define where somebody will and will not find meaning. And perhaps that will rule out finding meaning in destructive types of behavior. I'm not sure I buy it, to be honest. It's nice as a way to be able to sort of rule out terrorism as a means of finding meaning, which is good, because when you're counseling people, you want to sort of drop that one from the list. But I'm not sure I'm sold on this idea. You follow what he was saying? It takes some digestion, I realize. And I've been thinking about this for a long time. But what he's floating here as the idea is that we said before, meaning is about where you find meaning. Meaning is not what somebody can give you and tell you. And your search for that may take you in very different directions. What he's now suggesting is there is some set of activities that are in fact meaningful, that are defined outside of ourselves, and that's where a person might find meaning, and it may well exclude certain things. Certain activities will never be meaningful for human beings. That's what he's suggesting. I see a bunch of hands. I'm going to spend a couple of minutes on questions, but then I'm really going to go further. So, Elaine, Judith, and Sharon. Yeah?
I'm just puzzled where... So is Frankl rejecting the notion of a value system, cultural mores or religious values that traditionally, I think, in North American culture and in Judaism, live our lives by, which does direct us into what is meaningful activity.
Right. So,
so it sounds like he's like not looking at that or just
right. So he studiously tries in most of his work to avoid a value system, to avoid saying, you know, we believe that these things are good things to do, and therefore one could find meaning in them. What he's done in this last source is sort of go back towards that, to suggest there is in fact something outside of oneself that will define certain things. He has not, in this paragraph that I excerpted, said what it is, and if you read his entire book, Man's Search for Ultimate Meaning, he doesn't really give you such a clear expression of it, but he starts to veer towards the idea that in fact there may be a set of values involved. But he never went further than that, as far as I am aware. He certainly never identified it with a particular system. And that's true. Judith and Sharon. Yeah.
There is something referred to as a DMT, which is a molecule produced naturally in the body, but in great amounts of hallucinogenic drugs. And it's found in animals and humans and some plants, which have a universal presence. But it's referred to as a spirit molecule. So in reference to the statement that Frankl made, he may not be aware of this research at the time, that there is some aspect of our existence that he stored this religious, you know, perhaps.
Interesting. I'm not familiar with it. The spirit molecule, for those who couldn't hear, DMT, you said? I'll have to look into it. I'm not at all familiar with it. Naturally. Okay. Okay, Sharon.
That the meaning and purpose in life that he was getting, or other people would be looking for, is a reason to be alive. Like, people that, how come I survive the Holocaust? Why so many people die? Why am I here? And they look for a tikkun.
Interesting. So Sharon paints this in somewhat of a, what would end up being a religious perspective, really. That Frankl asks, why did I survive? But I would say that his why is, there are two different ways you can read the word why, right? Students of Talmud, sorry. There are two different ways you can read the word why. Why can mean towards what purpose, right? Or why could mean what was the reason. And I think he looks at it the second way. Not, God made me survive so that I could do X, but rather, I survived because of these factors, without attaching God to it. That's really more where he seems to go, at least as far as I've read. So let's talk about the question, though, about logotherapy and Judaism, because we spent almost 50 minutes at this point, and we haven't really done the Judaism piece of this. So before the war, he was a psychotherapist in Austria. Unclear to me what his religious identity was at that point. He goes through the camps as he describes in Man's Search for Meaning. While in the camps, he observes that those who have a meaning, those have a task for which they must live, a sense of value in their existence outside of their own existence, are more likely to survive. That was his observation. And in his writing and in his speaking, he is quite cognizant of his Judaism and comes across to me as spiritual / religious without knowing what he's doing in his observance. Take a look at source number 16, where he describes a moment in the camps. Instead of he had just gotten a coat. Instead of the many pages of my manuscript, which were now lost, I found in a pocket of the newly acquired coat a single page torn out of a Hebrew prayer book, which contained the main Jewish prayer, Shema Yisrael. How should I have interpreted such a coincidence, quote, other than as a challenge to live my thoughts instead of merely putting them on paper? He took it as a message, finding the Shema. Take a look at number 17, please, from Man's Search for Meaning. One day, a few days after the liberation, I walked through the country past flowering meadows for miles and miles toward the market town near the camp. Larks rose to the sky. I could hear their joyous song. There was no one to be seen for miles around. There was nothing but the wide earth and sky and the lark's jubilation and the freedom of space. I stopped, looked around and up to the sky, and then I went down on my knees. At the moment, there was very little I knew of myself or of the world. I have but one sentence in mind, always the same, and it's a passage from Tehillim, from Psalms. I called to the Lord from my narrow prison, and he answered me in the freedom of space. How long I knelt there and repeated the sentence, memory can no longer recall, but I know that on that day, in that hour, my new life started. Step for step, I progressed until I again became a human being. Sounds religious to me. I'm not going to take questions and comments at this point. I'm sorry, just because there's a lot to get to. In number 18, he talks about religious ritual. He says, as I see it, religion tries to give answers by offering man various answers in terms of myths and symbols, and it offers man a choice. By and large, he's born into such a language. Remember what I say about language is a system of symbols. Here I begin to pray, to put on in the morning my tefillin, where I cannot find rational answers, but have to commit myself, have to make my selection. I believe in this God, in this incomprehensible deity. I am approaching him by way of prayer, by way of rituals even, putting on the tefillin and in the evening reading the Psalms. This is my language when I address myself to God, and I abhor and would negate the right of anyone to say, Victor, why do you speak to the deity in this language? Why have you made it your habit since the first day in concentration camp to read in the Psalms each day? Why don't you accept the sacraments? Why don't you make confession to George Vlaus as a priest? He was on a panel with Father Vlaus. It sounds like the speech of a religious person to me. That's certainly what comes across. Although I have to admit, I'm not sure as I read it whether he's describing what he did or describing what he hypothetically would do. I think you could legitimately read it either way. But more important is the fact that he uses Jewish religious texts to explain ideas in logotherapy. He uses non-Jewish sources also. But he uses Jewish text in particular. Take a look at source number 19, from The Will to Meaning. He starts out here with a quote. If I don't do it, who will do it? And if I don't do it right now, when should I do it? But if I do it for my sake only, what am I? Who's he quoting?
Hillel.
Sort of. It's not a direct quote. He sort of mangled it a little bit. But it's basically Hillel and Pirkei Avot that he's quoted. And he says, if I don't do it, this seems to me to refer to the uniqueness of my own self. If I don't do it right now, refers to the uniqueness of the passing moment. If I do it for my own sake only, what here comes in is no more nor less than the self-transcendent quality of human existence. Right? The question, what am I, if I do it for my own sake only, requires the answer, in no event, a truly human being. He talks about Shabbos in source number 20. The meaning of Shabbat may well consist in reaching beyond work. There are creative values, we talked about this before. There are experiential values, experiencing something without creating. There are attitudinal values. This means we may find the meaning in our lives through a deed we are doing, through a work we are creating, through an achievement and accomplishment, through creativity, 6 days. But also through our experience. Not through what we give to the world, but what we receive from the world. What we take in. That's what you're doing on Shabbos. So, he's using the language of Judaism, even though he's not speaking to a Jewish audience, in order to convey his ideas. Now, he adamantly insists that logotherapy is not Jewish. He's very clear about that, and he explains why. He's concerned about reaching non-religious patients, right? People who don't associate with any religion, or people who don't associate with Judaism. He was afraid of being rejected by other psychologists. He said, they'll laugh at me if I start talking about religion in the context of psychotherapy. He was also very afraid of imposing the religion of the therapist on the patient. Right? When you start proposing meaning and you talk about Shabbos and tefillin and who knows what, you're imposing your religion. That's technically an unethical thing to do. It reminds me a lot, actually, of the sort of balance that Rabbi Dr. Avram Tursky does in his addictions writing. And he talks about spirituality, but he doesn't veer into Judaism. He's pretty careful with that. And I think he's right in the sense that religion and logotherapy complement each other. But a particular religion is not necessary for logotherapy to work. Having said that, and I'm going to abbreviate this last point. Having said that, I think logotherapy is very consistent with Judaism and Jewish ideas. The view of human nature, the uniqueness of the human being, is certainly found within Judaism. I brought you a passage from the Talmud in source number 21, in which we speak of the way that each human being is unique. The idea of free will is a basic underpinning of Judaism. As Maimonides writes, you don't have Jewish law without the concept of free will, the fact that we can choose. Otherwise, why command someone to do something if it's not their choice whether to fulfill it or not? You have to have free will. I brought you a passage from the Talmud that speaks about God determining all sorts of things about a person's life. But God will not determine whether someone is going to be wicked or righteous. That's up to the person. And certainly the importance of meaning. The idea that there are transcendent, things that are outside of ourselves, transcendent, valuable acts we are meant to fulfill in this world. First of all, what is a mitzvah if not that? Right? A transcendent, valuable act that we are meant to fulfill. Rabbi Chaim of Volozhin said, and he's quoted in number 23, that we are created not for ourselves, but to benefit others. Rabbi Shimshon Raphael Hirsch, in source number 24, talks about the role of the human being to actualize what it is that God wishes for this world. The importance of meaningful activity for our purpose as human beings. We talked about in a previous session what you see here in number 25, the idea that we are meant to be beings who have a mission, who have a job associated with God's will. The idea that happiness is not found in power and happiness is not found in pleasure is very strong for Frankl, and we find a midrash about it in source number 26. You never get what it is that you desire. And the neurosis that comes when we feel we're not pursuing meaning is everything we talked about when we dealt with depression a few weeks ago. Right? The idea that when a person is not pursuing meaning, we talked about the woman whose husband swears that she could never work. He's always going to have enough maids and she shouldn't work at all. And we warned that that leads to depression. A person needs to have meaningful activity, and without it, it can be devastating. And the way that we pursue meaning. Here's maybe a key difference. The big point of difference between where Frankl goes with logotherapy and where Judaism traditionally would go is that in Judaism, we're told these are meaningful activities. Logotherapy will never accept the idea that you tell somebody this is a meaningful activity. But in Judaism, we're being told, here is your set of meaningful activities. We look to revelation, effectively, to determine what is meaningful. But even there is a core element of personalization. I brought you a great quote from source number 27, Rabbi Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, the last Rosh Yeshiva, the last head of the Volozhin Yeshiva. He compared mitzvot to a garden. I know what kind of gardening they were doing in the end of 19th century Russia. I hope it involved plants that survived the winter. But he says, when you design a garden, you have a central color, central species of plant perhaps even, and that's the dominant one. And then all the other ones are oriented around it, and they offset and complement the main color that you're working with. That was his theory of garden design. Take it or leave it. You don't have to hire him as your landscaper. But his point is that in Judaism, you have a very broad Torah, with mitzvot that take us into the realm of helping others, with mitzvot that are more introspective, with mitzvot that are related to relating to God, with mitzvot of dress and food and so on. And Rabbi Berlin writes at length, I brought you a tiny excerpt from it. Rabbi Cook does the same thing in the poem that I brought you an excerpt of in source number 28. That ultimately the person specializes in that which resonates with them. You don't say to everybody, here's your 613, right, and do them all in equal measure. People will find that which resonates with them. Not to the exclusion of the others, Rabbi Berlin, Rabbi Cook, will not say, so just pick the mitzvah that you like and dump all the rest. But to say that you find what resonates with you, where you find that you are feeling that satisfaction that comes from pursuing meaning, and make that the central element of what you do, and everything else will complement it around it. And that is, I think, consistent with what Frankl wants, even if more limited than what Frankl designs, because it is coming ultimately from revelation. But that, I think, is a very strong way for Judaism to look at this, at the concept of logotherapy. And I do think that because you have all of these elements that we went through quickly in the last 10 minutes, but you have all of these ways in which logotherapy is consistent with Jewish ideas, I think that it can be, again, as I said at the beginning, not a therapist, not telling you what to do, not suggesting that it's for somebody, speak to somebody who actually does this as an expert, but I think that it can be useful for Jews. Thank you very much. As I said...